if you're a moron, I think you're probably in really good company here. With I certainly feel like I'm at home with them. Okay. Great. General Franks can't be here today. As you know, he's busy over in the Middle East and sends his regards. I hope you're not getting glued to CNN as I am, and the war is very captivating to have embedded media everywhere. I don't see any embedded media in here today, but maybe there's some sneaking. And we just by coincidence happened to have talked about that last week about the aftermath of the flood and the construction of the Tower of Babel and Nimrod's exploits, which take place in Iraq. After the flood, Noah and Shem, Ham, and Japheth, his sons and their wives, 8 persons, migrated, as far as we know, down from Turkey, from eastern Turkey, into the Fertile Crescent area of the Tigris and Euphrates rivers, and settled there, which is a fertile plain. As you've probably seen from the satellite maps on television, it's a lush area to this very day. And there they began to multiply and fill up the earth. Nimrod, the grandson of Ham, is highlighted in chapter 10 and again in chapter 11 as the mighty hunter before the Lord, as the man who led the first organized rebellion to secularize society and built a number of cities, built Babylon, which happens to be about 60 miles southwest of Baghdad, built Nineveh up in the north in the Kurdish territory right near the city of Mosul, which is right in the news lately. Abraham, who comes up in chapter 12, comes from Ur. The Ur is right adjacent to Al-Nasiriyah. So if you're watching the news, you're looking right at the cradle of civilization where an awful lot of things happened. The old Babylonian Empire is in this particular time period and runs on down through the time of Abraham. Then the old Babylonian Empire sort of fades down into insignificance for a long period of time. Then we get that great revival of Babylon under Nebuchadnezzar in the time of Daniel. At the time the Jews are taken into captivity, Babylon has a very major role in the affairs of the Middle East. It has had from ancient times, and it's not over yet, because Isaiah 13 and 14, Jeremiah 50-51 talk about the future of Babylon and the literal city of Babylon, and we mentioned that last time. And it's at Babylon where God came down and took the earth's one language and confounded it into a plurality of languages, making it difficult for human beings to communicate and making it necessary for them to scatter and fill the earth as God had intended, not to localize and centralize their self-government, particularly since that self-government was leaving God out of the whole equation. There's a lot then. We talked a little bit briefly about the mystery of Babylon, Babylonian mystery religions as the wellspring of all of the idolatry in the world that has permeated the whole world since the flood. Religious error traces itself back to Nimrod's mystery religion, and that's a whole vast subject. And so we stopped at chapter 11, verse 9. And so today let's pick up at chapter 11 of Genesis at verse 10. And we'll run all the way quickly down 10 generations to Abraham here. This is the genealogy of Shem. Remember earlier we had a little short summary of the genealogies of Ham and Japheth. They were sort of a brief abbreviated. And now we're getting much more of the family line of Shem. Ray Sedgman calls this God's funnel. History's funneling down again. All sorts of things are spinning off. We're not going to hear anything more about Japheth for a long time. We don't want to hear anything much more about Ham. We're going to hear about Shem, and Shem's going to take us to Abraham. And then after that, we're going to get the history of the Jewish people all the way down to the Messiah. So we don't know much about the rest of the nations. We don't learn anything about what's going on in the rest of the world. The history of the rest of the world sort of drops out of the biblical account. And as a matter of fact, here at this point, we're going to come to one of God's long silences, a period of maybe 500 or 1,000 years in which God doesn't say anything. Much like the silent years between the Old Testament and the New Testament. We'd love to have all kinds of information on how the early civilizations of the ancient world started up after the flood. What about the early civilizations in China and India and Europe and Egypt, and we simply don't know from the Bible very much about that. Because we've got these 10 generations listed here now that take us down to Abraham, but with almost nothing at all said about what's going on anywhere else. And not hardly anything said about what's going on in Shem. So let's just read this. This is the genealogy of Shem. Now that's probably a closing signature that indicates the, I think, Shem's signature on the previous section. That this is the end of Shem's diary, and now this section is going to be written by Terah. At least that's in my Toledot model. And this manuscript will get down to finally to Moses, and he'll write it down, and it'll be the book of Genesis. This is the genealogy of Shem. Now then, that would be a period. Shem was 100 years old, and he begot Arpachshad 2 years after the flood. Well, that fits what we know. The ark was under construction for maybe 100 years, and they've come off the ark now, and 2 years after the flood, Shem, who is the second son of Noah, has his son Arpachshad. After he begot Arpachshad, Shem lived 500 more years, and he begot sons and daughters. And so right away we get a clue that the family size is likely to be at least about 6 children, maybe more. That figures very strongly in how quick the world population grows. If the world population growth was 2 children per family, then the population growth is 0. With 5 or 6 children per family, you get a very rapid population growth. Fill the world up really quickly. Probably get to 1 million or 2 million people by the time we get down to Abraham. The Tower of Babel, world population being some thousands, maybe 10,000 people only. Okay? We're also notice we get on this list how the lifespans are shrinking gradually. For what reasons, we don't exactly know. Verse 12, Arpachshad lived 35 years and he begot Selah. Well, there's a change there, and that is that earlier on, people didn't seem to have children until they were about 100 years old. Now we find that Arpachshad has his first son at age 35. Then he begot Selah. After he begot Selah, Arpachshad lived 403 years, and he begot sons, plural, daughters, plural, at least 2 sons, at least 2 daughters, plus his son, at least 5 children, maybe more. Selah lived 30 years, and he begot Eber. Eber's the man from where we get the word Hebrew. After he begot Eber, Selah lived 403 years, and he begot sons and daughters, plural, sons. Eber lived 34 years, and he begot Peleg. Peleg is that controversial name, which means division, from which we get pelagic deeps of the ocean, and from which we get the whole possibility that suggested of the division of the continents, which is only one little verse here that archipelago. It's got his name in it. After he begot Peleg, Eber lived 430 years and begot sons and daughters. Peleg lived 30 years and begot Reu, and after he begot Reu, Peleg lived 209 years and begot sons and daughters. Reu lived 32 years and begot Serug, and after he begot Serug, Reu lived 207 years and he begot sons and daughters. Serug lived 30 years and begot Nahor. After he begot Nahor, Serug lived 200 years and begot sons and daughters. So the firstborn son is named here. That's kind of how this succession is. The promise to Eve of the coming Messiah. That's how this is all passing all the way down. Eventually it gets to Jesus after 50, 60 generations. Nahor lived 29 years and begot Terah. And after he begot Terah, Nahor lived 119 years and begot sons and daughters. Terah lived 70 years and begot Abraham, Nahor, and Haran. And now we've gotten down 10 generations, we've gotten all the way down to the man Abraham. And now we can begin to get an agreement with secular dating, because most people would agree that Abraham was born maybe about 2200 B.C. This is the point National Geographic will begin to talk as if this was real history and speculate on this man Abraham, who, as far as we know, was born down in the southern part of Iraq and the man that God called. Now, what is in between the lines here is that the spiritual condition of mankind is deteriorating over this long 10 generations. Men are gradually losing track of God. They came off the ark enlightened, instructed, godly in their conduct and behavior, and all 3 branches of the human family all had knowledge of Jehovah and knowledge of sacrifice and good understanding of what life was like, and it's all going to quietly disappear. The whole point of in the family of Shem is that there is nevertheless a godly remnant that's been preserved. God's preserving a remnant in the line of Shem. Now we get down to Terah, the father of Abraham, who lives down at El Nasriya, down at Ur in Chaldees. Joshua tells us that Terah was a worshiper of idols, that he wasn't worshiping God anymore, and his family wasn't. So sometime in this 10 generations, people have gotten way far away from the one true God and lapsed into polytheism. And that's, of course, one of the themes that's come up here in Genesis is the downward spiral of the human race from a state of enlightenment and knowledge of God into polytheism and idolatry and animism, much like we see in Romans chapter 1. Human beings forgetting God, turning to other sources of worship, God giving them up, people losing their knowledge of God and becoming slaves of various gods. Downhill, not the advance of civilization, but the deterioration of civilization. And we get down now to verse 27. This is the genealogy of Terah. Terah begot Abram, Nahor, and Haran begot Lot. That Lot and Abraham are going to hang out together as uncle and nephew. After Haran died before his father Terah in the native land in Ur of the Chaldeans. Southern part of Iraq is Chaldea. The northern part, by the way, it's very interesting that the Kurds up in the north are Japhethites, and they're probably related to the ancient Medes. Interesting. And they've been much more open to Christianity, and they're much less, hence their affinity for being liberated. And also Saddam has been very mean to the Kurds, as you know, and gassed a number of them and wiped them out, and so they don't like him very well. But they may well be descendants of the ancient Medes. Medi, if you remember, in the line of Japheth. So the current people living over there have got, there's some ancient roots going over there. Now, we get all the way down to Abraham, and now if you want to continue in the life of Abraham, we're going to stop our time in Genesis here at this point. But if you want to read up about Abraham, Ray's book is very good. Man of Faith, maybe out of print, but it's certainly on the website. And Abraham is held out for us as the example of a life of faith. What God does in Abraham is to call him back to the faith of his fathers, to awaken him and in sovereignty, call him back into a relationship with God and ask him to leave Ur and to journey off into the land that is now Israel and to make a home there. And God made a series of promises to Abraham, and every time that Abraham responded to one of the calls of God, God blessed him and enlightened him, and he became the father of all of monotheism, the father of all who believe, the New Testament says. And you all know the story that he's 70 years old before he ever even left Ur, stayed up in Haran, which is up in Syria at the north end of the Euphrates River, is up there, stayed there for 5 years, and then finally went on over to take his tribes and herds and go live in the land of Israel. God promised him his son. He and his wife had no son, and they waited 25 years until their legitimate son Isaac was born. And before that was the affair with Ishmael, you probably know. There's a lot of the feuding in the Middle East that's Isaac and Ishmael to this very day, and Esau and Jacob, and a lot of those feuds over there are very ancient tribal disputes that are still going on today. So with the life of Abraham, this funnel that we started in Genesis has narrowed down to one man, one key man, from whom the Muslims and Judaism and Christianity all owes its earliest roots, and the father of monotheism. Well, this isn't the first time that monotheism has come into the world. This is a renewal of what mankind once knew. There are flood legends in all of the civilizations of the world. We should not be surprised if we go off and look at what we know about ancient civilizations to find evidence that they once knew a lot more about God than they now do. We shouldn't be surprised if we find some truth in all the religions of the world, the memory of knowledge that the peoples once possessed. We should also not assume that God is ignoring the rest of the nations of the world, because he obviously has always been interested in all of mankind. We simply aren't told about people who believed in God out in the families of Japheth and Ham. But we can assume that in general there's a deterioration away from God. And then who knows what God has been doing. The whole purpose of the theme of the Bible is to focus us on the promise of the coming Messiah. We've all seen already in Genesis how much we would have loved to have known more about life before the flood. We would have just loved to know all about that, and weren't told anything. And we're given so little information on all sorts of subjects that we'd like to know. And not very much science here to tell us the details of creation. And that's one of the things about the scriptures, is that God wants us to focus on redemption. And when we all get to heaven, we can talk to all these patriarchs and get the true story from them and go read. Probably Noah's diary will be on the internet by then, and we can go chat with Abraham. So this is the place we'll drop off in Genesis. Now, at the very beginning, last December when we started, this is week 13, I think. And you guys are so patient. Last week I caught up on all the tapes. I put the tapes on my website, and I had to listen to them, and I thought, those are terrible. Why do these people keep coming back here week after week? Just like my notes are terrible, and I was embarrassed, and I thought, boy, if anything good comes out of the class, it's not my doing, it's the Lord. And to go through all this again, as I've mentioned before, it's very reaffirming to me to realize that we are created by an intelligent God. We don't have to fuss about the details of the how or the when, but we certainly have here a clear record that we were brought into existence by a great creator. I think I also mentioned that the Bible never gives you truth on any given subject in one place. There's no chapter on marriage and another chapter on adultery and another chapter on idolatry. The scripture teaches a little bit here and there. So if we wanted to know more about creation, we sort of presupposes you've read the whole Bible through, because you're going to get little bits and pieces that complement and add to what we've already studied. So for the next couple of weeks, that's what I would like to do, like jump around and look at other parts of the scripture that answer to and fill in some of the things about creation. So we'll do that. And today I'd like to look at three Psalms. We could look at Psalm 104, first of all. Remember, we're now looking not at the prose of Genesis. Genesis is very accurate Hebrew prose, and now we can go look at poetry, which is a very different way of expressing things. Oh my gosh, look at here. I got an answer. When did Latin come about? Since many of our words come from Latin. Boy, who knows the answer to that one? Well, we know that when did the Greek language began to pervade Europe in what, a few hundred B.C.? And then after that comes the rise of the Roman civilization. I don't know how old the Latin language is. We have a lot of Greek words in our English language, and then we have a lot of language. Yeah. Peter probably wrote this question out so you could answer it. Thank you. They're a real, this reference scholar here is one of our consultants. Anybody else have any thoughts on this? In the Roman Empire, Greek was the common language. And so Latin moves into the vogue more a little bit later, doesn't it? Okay, well, that's the first embarrassing question that I didn't have the answer to. Now, look at Psalm. I have to be very, very careful what I let you people ask here, because my ignorance comes right up. Blessed, Psalm 104. Psalm 104 is a response to creation, as I think you'll see. It sort of echoes Genesis 1. And the Psalms now will really begin, I think, to highlight our worship and gratitude to God for the creation and the universe we live in. Bless the Lord, O my soul, says the psalmist. O Lord, my God, you are very great. You are clothed with honor and majesty. who cover yourself with light as with a garment, who stretch out the heavens like a curtain. That sort of sounds like Genesis 1 a little bit. Let there be light, God clothing himself in light and stretching out the heavens like a curtain. That's that day 2 of creation week, the firmament. He lays the beams of his upper chambers in the waters. I don't know what that's all about, but that, to try to make that too literal, it's beautiful poetry, but he lays the beams of his upper chambers in the waters, who makes the clouds his chariot, who walks on the wings of the wind, who makes his angels spirits, his ministers a flame of fire. That last verse is quoted in Hebrews in reference to the God's creation of the angels, who are his messengers likened to winds and fires, powerful, mighty angels. And the clouds are like his chariot. So we have a God here who's transcended over the creation. A God who is lofty and grand and who's the creator of everything. And this lays the beams on the chambers of waters. We've talked about the fact that right on day one of creation, we have waters, but primeval waters, not hot flowing lava. Verse 5, you who laid the foundations of the earth so that it should never be moved. Some people think that that's where we Christians get the idea that we live in a flat earth that's anchored someplace that doesn't move. Well, that isn't obviously what this is all about. You who laid the foundations of the earth so that it should not be moved forever. Obviously, that does not deny a spinning globe at all. It simply means that time and history are under God's full control, and as long as he desires to keep the stars in their place and the earth in its orbit, it's unthreatened and unchallenged. It's going to be there. You covered it with the deep as with a garment. Now we're back to the creation of the earth again. You covered the deep as with a garment. The waters stood above the mountains. At your rebuke they fled. At the voice of your thunder they hastened away. Now we're looking at the earth as a sphere of water with no land. Peter says the earth was formed out of water and by means of water. So we have this primeval ocean. And then God raises the earth's continent out of the waters. The waters went up over the mountains. They went down into the valleys to the place where you founded for them. You have set a boundary that they may not pass over, that they may not return to cover the earth. So here's God pulling up the earth's continent and establishing a boundary for the seacoasts. In a way, this sounds like the flood, but I don't think it's the flood. I think this is creation week. And some commentaries on the Psalms would suggest that we're talking about the flood of Noah here, but I don't think so. So we have a secure boundary for the shores of the oceans around the earth's continent. He sends the springs into the valleys, which flow among the hills. As we suggested that maybe there was no rainfall before the flood, that maybe there were great springs from which the four rivers of Eden spring up, and that most of the water for agriculture came up out of springs because of the pressurized water in the crust of the earth. He sends the springs into the valleys which flow among the hills. They give drink to every beast of the field. The wild donkeys quench their thirst. By them the birds of the heavens have their habitation. They sing among the branches. He waters the hills from his upper chambers. That would be rainfall and mist and dew. The earth is satisfied with the fruit of your works. Now here's the God who's the God of nature and the God who's productive, the God who loves the animals and plants and is providing an environment for man and devotes himself to that. He causes the grass to grow for the cattle, vegetation for the service of man, that he may bring forth food from the earth and wine that makes glad the heart of man, oil to make his face shine, and bread which strengthens man's heart. We're sort of going through creation week. We get the creation of the universe and then the formation of the earth and then the seeds and plants and the environment and man comes last on there and the whole system, the whole ecosystem is in place. The trees of the Lord are full of sap. The cedars of Lebanon, which he planted, where the birds make their nests. The stork has her home in the fir trees. The high hills are for wild goats. The cliffs are a refuge for the rock badgers. Here's God's lavish attention to detail in nature and his creation of all of the myriad of life forms and his attendance to all of them. Not a sparrow falls to the ground, but what your heavenly Father sees it. So here's the God who's vitally involved in everything that goes on in nature all around us. Give us a new respect and regard for the the ecosystem that we're embedded in. He appointed the moon for seasons. That's day four of creation week. He appointed the moon for seasons. That's the lunar calendar, which becomes the calendar for the Jews. And so on, the sun knows it's going down. You make darkness, and it is night, in which all the beasts of the forest creep around. The young lions roar after their prey and seek their food from God. When the sun arises, they gather together and lie down in their dens. Man goes out to his work and to his labor until the evening. Beautiful here, the man now involved on the earth, laboring and working, and the animals there going about their life cycles. And beautiful work of creation. Day six, kind of day seven of the creation week. O Lord, how manifold are your works. In wisdom you have made them all. The earth is full of your possessions. Who owns the planet and who owns it? We're just guest residents here. This great and wide sea, in which are innumerable teeming things, living things both small and great. You're reminding us of all of the life in the oceans. There the ships sail about, and there is that Leviathan which you made to play there. Leviathan comes up again in Job, and the sea monster may be a creature that's now extinct, or maybe a whale, it may be, who knows. But Leviathan and Behemoth are great creatures that are mentioned in Job. And God made this great sea creature to sport in the earth, to enjoy it, apart from us. These all wait for you, that you may give them their food in due season. There, God's taking responsibility to feed all the creatures of the earth, not just us. Provide food by one means or another for everybody. Up earlier, it talked about the lions getting their food from God, and that's probably the time when they weren't wild animals of prey, like they are now. Verse 28, what you give them, they gather in. You open your hand, and they are filled with good. God is bountiful in his love for nature and creation. Awakens in us a new kind of, I think, a responsibility of our relationship with nature. We don't live out in the country, but I'm sure you have pets and you enjoy your gardens and you enjoy a hike in the hills. And that's because we can't really take man out of his environment. We're made to be part of an environment. So I think New Jerusalem will be a nice place with waterfalls and green growing things. And people always send me email and want to know if their pets are in heaven, and I don't know. Probably Aslan is there, and some of those nice creatures in the Narnia stories are probably there, and more. And God, because God loves these creatures. And look at the nature programs and the animal. We'll look at all the variety in nature and all of the, sometimes the humor of God and the delight of God in designing and inventing all these amazing creatures. And they're not just for our benefit. We're related to them, but God just delights in his work as the creator. When God, verse 29, when he hides his face, when God hides his face, they are troubled. That's the animals are troubled. You take away their breath, they die and return to their dust. We all live and die at God's pleasure, and so do the animals. You send forth your spirit, and they are created. Barah. You create the face of the earth. That God's the creator and the renewer of the universe. And he's building a new creation. We'll talk about that next week or so. May the glory of the Lord endure forever. May the Lord rejoice in his works. He looks on the earth, it trembles. He touches the hills and they smoke. Volcanoes and earthquakes and natural events. And the psalmist says, I will sing to the Lord as long as I live. I will sing praise to my God while I have my being. May my meditation be sweet to him. I will be glad in the Lord. May sinners be consumed from the earth and the wicked be no more. Bless the Lord, O my soul. Praise the Lord. Now the psalmist then has meditated on God, the God who's the creator, and looked at the creation and delighted in it and seen the handiwork of God and the love of God reflected everywhere in nature. And what does it lead him to? It leads him to worship. Well, now when you're back to worship again, you're back to where God created you to be. That's the first thing that goes in your life when you start getting away from God, is the failure to be in gratitude and worship and reverence and awe of God, who's done all these things. The psalmist obviously awakens that in us again, makes us stop and thank God for the wonderful world we live in. Okay, so Psalm 104 then is a psalm that very much is a reflection on the creation week, pretty much, okay? Psalm 19 is a great psalm. We'll look at that a little bit. And I've just picked a few random psalms because the psalms are full of stuff on the creation. Psalm 19 is a very great psalm. There's quite a few hymns in the church were written after this psalm, and this is the psalm of two books. It's really a very insightful psalm if you just stop and look at it a little bit. Psalm 19. Then this one is attributed to David. And the psalm goes into two parts. Some people think it could even be two psalms. The first six verses sound like a separate psalm than the last half. Okay, let's look at the first six verses of this psalm and see how there's some real neat theology here. The heavens declare the glory of God. The word there is El, not Elohim, which is more usual, but just the plain, unvarnished word El, which means God. Okay? That's going to switch at verse 7. We're going to switch to Yahweh, the covenant name of God switches, and then the covenant name of God occurs seven times in the second half of the psalm. Okay, so we look at this division. The heavens declare the glory of God, and the firmament shows His handiwork. Day unto day utters speech, and night unto night reveals knowledge. There is no speech nor language where their voice is not heard. Their line has gone out through all the earth, and their words to the end of the world. In them He has set a tabernacle for the sun, which is like a bridegroom coming out of his chamber, and rejoices like a strong man to run its race. Its rising is from one end of heaven, and its circuit to the other end, and there is nothing hidden from its heat. Heat of the sun. Okay, what's this all about? What's those six verses about? This is what we get the whole idea of what's called general revelation. General revelation. This is what Paul draws on in Romans 1 when he says all men are without excuse, that the creation gives ample evidence to every human being of the existence of a creator. Okay, this is foundational then. This is a foundational psalm because here we see that God reveals Himself in nature and proves that there is intelligent design and there's a creator behind the scenes in the universe. Now, how does this work out? Because the second part of the psalm is really about special revelation, which is another dimension. Now, what do we learn from nature that this psalm's talking about? Well, he calls attention to the stars and the heavens to start with. Now, does this contradict science? Can you look through a telescope and deny this the truth here? What is all this? What's this reference to day and night uttering speech and night unto night revealing knowledge and the universality of this word, this book, the book of God's work in nature? Where do you find it? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes, that's great. Isn't that good? And this immediately takes, as C.S. Lewis comments on this psalm, that this is where nature is emptied of divinity. And the pagan religions assign divinity and the powers of the gods to nature. And this takes that all right away. It shows that God's above that. And I like what you said about this is a silent speech. This is a silent. How does this work? Where do you look and see this and read this book? Well, you read it through a telescope. The more you learn about the stars and the galaxies and the mysteries of space, that produce wonder, reverence, and awe and marvel. It ought to. Now you look at the world of the microscope. We look at insects and bacteria and small forms of life. Do you see design, order, intricacy, purpose? Yes. Look in your own heart. What do you see within your own self? What do you see? Do you see a conscience? Do you see a mind? Do you see the hunger for God? Do you see within your own self the evidence that you are a created being? Is this voice everywhere? Well, yes, it's everywhere. Then to deny this voice is a lot of hard work, isn't it? To pretend that this is all a big cosmic accident and it's a big joke and it just happened. It gets more and more absurd. You see the denial of this unceasing voice that the creation is shouting this out. And then he talks about the sun, as if the sun was animated and it goes at night into its tent, and that's why we have darkness. And then the sun rises up with its splendor in the morning and marches across the sky, and you marvel at the day and the weather patterns and the progression from morning to evening and the seasons. Marvel at all that. Is that evidence of God? Yes, it is. There's nothing hidden from its heat. Now, this is obviously the observer. David's on the earth, and he's used to hot summers in the Middle East and cool breezes, and everything's all orchestrated by this unseen creator. So here's the evidence in nature that testifies the existence of God and makes all men without excuse. This is what we call general revelation. General revelation is, notice there's no moral element in this at this point. It's not moral. It doesn't tell you right from wrong. It just simply says, look, there's a God who created all this. He's grand, he's high, he's lofty, he's transcendent, he's awesome. He made you. You need to obviously pay attention to this creator. Romans 3 closes by saying about modern man that there's no fear of God before his eyes. That's one thing that's gone from our modern culture. Fear, reverence, awe, and respect for God's gone pretty well. Well, here's where you get it back again. Okay? Now, the second part of the psalm. Switch, big switch. The first part of the psalm uses relatively long phrases. The second part of the psalm, the style changes into a series of short phrases and six parallelisms right in the first three verses that are, we're now talking about Yahweh, the law, but we're now talking about the God who is a moral God, the God who enters into personal relationships with people. Not everybody. But he enters into a relationship with you. And now what happens when you discover that God's real and he's a person and you can know him? Now then, the psalmist reflects on that. This is what we call special revelation. Special revelation tells us a great deal more that we'd never discover by just observing the heavens. Never figure that out. This is God's revelation of himself personally to us. And this is moral. The law of the Lord is perfect, converting the soul. The Torah, it's really the Torah of the Lord, is perfect, converting the soul. Now we get something that's transforming and life-changing and something that provides us guidance for our lives. The law of the Lord is perfect, converting the soul. The testimony of the Lord is sure, making wise the simple. That's Romans. That's 1 Corinthians 1 and 2 that talks about what happens when people forget about God, that God gives them over to prove themselves to be fools. And this is the path that leads to wisdom and to enlightenment. And it comes through the law of the Lord. The law of the Lord is the revelation of what he is like. It's not just the law of Moses. It's the law, it's the revelation of God in the scriptures that tells us what kind of a person he is. That he's holy and that he's just and he's righteous and he's loving. Verse 8, the statutes of the Lord are right, rejoicing the heart. The commandment of the Lord is pure, enlightening the eyes. See, he's telling us all the advantages of knowing God and knowing his word and knowing the Torah and following and obeying, that all these benefits begin to be ours personally. We begin to see things as they really are. The fear of the Lord is clean, enduring forever. The judgments of the Lord are true and righteous together. I was thinking about the one thing about the characterizes this war, it seems to me in many ways, is that our leadership to a large extent seems to be showing love, truth, and righteousness, which you don't usually see in a war. You see wars fought for all the wrong reasons and selfish motives, but it seems to me that my personal feeling is that we've got love, truth, and righteousness in somewhat of a balance this time. And that's what makes this war so puzzling to our enemies. They'd like to hear about a God of love or a God of truth, but not God of righteousness, not a God who actually goes out in the world and is just, acts justly and compassionately. But see, all of those. Yeah, Russ. Freaks out our allies. Even our allies. Yeah, it does. You see where I'm coming from on the war. I'm not popular at Stanford today. The fear of the Lord is clean, enduring forever. The judgments of the Lord are true and righteous altogether. Now we get the God of justice and the God of truth and the God of right conduct. More to be desired are they than gold. Yes, much more than fine gold, sweeter than honey and the honeycomb. Moreover, by them your servant is warned. And in keeping them, there's great reward. There's the spiritual life of walking with Jesus and knowing Him and being enriched and enlightened and blessed and fulfilled. Is that what that's all about? And giving the guidelines that keep us out of trouble. All the little checks and balances that God gives us that keep us on the right path. That's here. Who can understand His errors? Which one of us really knows himself very well? Which one of us doesn't make dumb mistakes all the time unless we are leaning on the Lord? Who can understand His errors? And then the psalmist says, cleanse me from secret faults. Oh Lord, I've got flaws that I'm not aware of. Maybe You can show me the things I don't know about myself, the things that others see, the way I can hurt people or cut them down or put them down, even unintentionally. Keep back Your servant from presumptuous sins. Presuming on God's grace and presuming on other people's kindness and goodness. Intruding in on things that aren't my business. That's what that's about. Let them not have dominion over me. Let me not be arrogant and overbearing. That's presumptive sin. Then I shall be blameless and I shall be innocent of great transgression. David's talking from his own experience about how much he needs the Lord to stay on the right track. And what happens when he doesn't follow the Lord? Get off track quick. Let the words of my mouth and the meditation of my heart be acceptable in Your sight, O Lord, my rock and my redeemer. There, isn't that great? He ends up on the rock, the solid foundation, the solid rock that anchors you morally. Mm-hmm. Yes, I remember. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes, Psalm 119 is very much, it springs out of the same thing. The main divisions in this psalm then are the God of general revelation who speaks in nature so that all are without excuse, the God who's shouting at us silently in everything we look at, and that we can therefore wonder and find wonder and awe in everything we investigate and everything we look at. Then there's the God of personal knowledge that we can know personally and love and follow and respond to. Pretty incredible that the God who created the universe would also be a covenant-making personal being. And so that's what this psalm shows. And see, we didn't get that back in Genesis very much, did we? We got the covenants a little bit, but here it's pretty clear. Now, Psalm 139, just by which I've always loved, is kind of neat and relevant for our time. And I'm just picking these sort of arbitrarily. This is also by David. And it talks with this psalm about the attributes of God, about God's omniscience first, and then His omnipresence, and then His omnipotence. And then the last part of the psalm is about relating to God. So this would tell us more about, gives us some good solid theology. O Lord, You have searched me and known me. You have known my sitting down and my rising up. You understand my thought afar off. You comprehend my path and my lying down. You're acquainted with all my ways. There is not a word on my tongue, but behold, O Lord, You know it altogether. You have hedged me behind and before, and You've laid Your hand upon me. Such knowledge is too wonderful for me. It is high. I cannot attain it. There's a God who knows absolutely everything about you and then knows the nighttime and the daytime and your private life and your public life and your whole family history and all of the idiosyncrasies of your personality. And there's just no way that you can avoid the omniscience, the all-knowing God. Well, it's very scary to some people if you would like to not have God know you, but it's a delight to, if you want to know God. It's great that your Creator would like to love you, and He knows enough about you never to be caught off guard or upset by what you do. So that's what David is telling us about the omniscience of God. Now he said the omnipresence of God means you can never get away from His presence. Where shall I go from Your Spirit? If you decided you did want to hide from God out of guilt or shame or whatever, where would you go? Or if you were in trouble or in danger and surrounded by your enemies, would God not be there? No, He'd be there. Where should I go from Your Spirit, or where can I flee from Your presence? If I ascend into heaven, You're there. If I make my bed in hell and Sheol, there You're there too. If I take the wings of the morning and dwell in the uttermost parts of the sea, even there Your hand shall lead me, and Your right hand shall hold me. If I say, surely the darkness shall fall on me, even the night shall be light about me. Indeed, the darkness shall not hide from you, but the night shines as the day. The darkness and the light are both alike to you. That's interesting. The New Testament says that men who do evil generally prefer to do it at night under the cover of darkness. Crime and immorality and stuff goes on after midnight and wild drunk parties and things because people think they're hiding from God. And this psalm here shows that God, that the darkest nighttime is bright to him. Hebrews says the same sort of thing, that all of our secret sins are right in the face of God all the time. So he sees this is the omnipresence of God. And this is intended to be comforting. This is not supposed to drive you to bats because you can't get away from God. This is supposed to say that whatever circumstances you find yourself in, God's right there to be of help to you. And if you're running away from him, you can turn to him from wherever you are, and he'll be happy to meet you and restore you. So that's good. And now then, the omnipotence of God. Verse 13. You have formed my inward parts. You have covered me in my mother's womb. I will praise you. I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Marvelous are your works. That my soul knows very well. My frame was not hidden from you when I was made in secret and skillfully wrought in the lowest parts of the earth. In my mother's womb, in other words. Your eyes saw my substance being yet unformed, and in your book they all were written, the days fashioned for me when as yet there were none of them. How precious also are your thoughts to me, O God. How great is the sum of them. If I should count them, they would be more in number than the sand. When I awake, I am still with you. Well, now that's a King David talking about being an embryo in the womb of his mother. It's talking about his identity going back to before birth. It's going back to conception. When God, as if God had personally engineered the creation of this child that was going to grow up to be King David. I think this is one of the strongest passages we have to establish the sanctity of life for the unborn and to show the horror of abortion and the wrongness of the moral wrongness, because here's the very clear that God's handiwork in the bringing every individual into the world and his involvement in that. Now, you would like to think that maybe the secular view would be, well, nature makes babies in the womb of a mother by just an ordinary biological process of a sperm and an ovum coming together and generating a child, and it's all a matter of built-in genetics. Well, this psalm contradicts that. This psalm shows that God's personal involvement in the whole details of your conception and growth and formation and his loving care from you before you were ever brought into the world. I think this makes shows the moral that your identity as a person preceded your even coming onto the face of the earth. You didn't become a person at birth. You became a person probably at conception. You see that in there? The loving care of God in your... Now, that's also kind of neat that makes you very special to him from before you were ever even born. God's handiwork and his omnipotence, his involvement. God does not mind getting involved in the details of the management and operation of the whole universe. He built the genetics into the Adam and Eve, but that doesn't mean he leaves the universe to run itself. He's involved in everything that goes on. The moral God, a loving God. Okay? Verse 19. Oh, that you would slay the wicked, O God. David's reflecting. He's reflecting on his own life, and he's reflecting also on the intimacy of his relationship with God and how much he enjoys communion with God and God sharing his thoughts. Oh, that you would slay the wicked, O God. Depart from me, therefore, you bloodthirsty men. They speak against you wickedly. Your enemies take your name in vain. Do I not hate them, O Lord, who hate you? And do I not loathe those who rise up against you? I hate them with perfect hatred. I count them my enemies. I think that in recent weeks, I think you can see, maybe first time in a long time, a polarization in the world between the people who love and know God and the people who hate God. There's more and more people who hate and despise God are kind of coming out in the open, and you can see the contrast between people who believe and not believe. Maybe in recent years that was sort of all smoothed over, but I think it's sort of sharpening up a little bit now. And of course, David in his life had real enemies that were flesh and blood enemies that were out to get him. So this is a little bit of a call for vengeance on those that would take his life. Finally, he says, "Search me, O God, and know my heart. Try me and know my anxieties, and see if there is any wicked way in me, and lead me in the way everlasting." Isn't that a great prayer? A great prayer as he reflects on the omniscience of God, the omnipresence of God, the omnipotence of God, and he thinks about his relationship with God and who God is, and then what his greatest need in his heart is for God's guidance and the core of his being. So these are my choice of three psalms. Next week, we're going to look at the closing chapter of Job. You think you got all creation all figured out? We'll shoot that right down next week as we'll see what God said to Job in the last couple chapters of Job. Then we'll run off the New Testament a little bit and do a little bit of what we can find out about creation from the New Testament, and then end up with a little bit on the new creation, because you're all part of a new creation. I haven't said much about that. How about some thoughts, comments, contradictions, insults? I pretend that you're the media here, and I've just given you a press briefing, and you're supposed to ask antagonistic, hostile questions. Yeah, they'd never gotten involved with Hagar and never had Ishmael, or they kept Ishmael in the family. There's one thing about these patriarchs. The character of nations seems to very much be related to the personality of the patriarch. These sons of Abraham, for instance, and after Sarah died, you know, he married Keturah and had another, 10 more sons or so? And they're all part of his big Middle Eastern family. They do have an affinity. They don't totally hate each other. They are family, in a way, once the hostility's out of there. Jesus is the one that's going to bring all these nations back together again. Jesus is the one whose love for all of mankind already embraces the whole world. He's no favoritism towards the Jews now. And so this is how the book ends. The book ends with Jesus gathering these nations that are all split apart in faction and bringing us back together into one big human family. So I think that's one of the interesting things about the way Genesis is written. And it shows the human race spreading all out in diversity and apostasy, and God, the regathering. Yes? I don't know, because the climate probably changed. The earth was pretty unstable as far as climate back in those early days. The rivers have moved around a little bit and sedimented in, and they could have had more rainfall. It could have been much more lush over the whole area back then. Right now, most of the green land is in between the Tigris and the Euphrates, and a lot of that land out the west is right now is desert. Wouldn't have to have a lot more rainfall until you get enough grass out there to graze crops. If the world as mankind spreads from Babylon, they're going to have to spread out to parts of the world where you can support herds and cattle and grow things. So that's going to force mankind to spread off into Europe and down into Africa and so on. Nimrod, grandson of Ham. Mm-hmm. I didn't mention that, I don't think, but Nimrod's the grandson of Ham, who becomes Marduk, the Marduk of the Babylonian mystery religion. His wife is Semiramis. Semiramis had a virgin-born son, Tammuz. And it's legend, yeah. And there's some books. I mentioned the book Two Babylons, which I can't find my copy at home. And yes, ma'am. Yes. The handmaiden is Hagar. She's Egyptian. The son is Ishmael. Then is Abraham's the father, and Hagar's the mother, and they're sort of thrown out twice. And the first time, the angel of the Lord comes and deals with Hagar and promises, makes a covenant with Hagar. There is a covenant with Hagar. Then there's a covenant with Ishmael in which God promises to bless them and protect them. That hasn't worked itself out in history. For example, Isaiah says that Egypt has a great future in the kingdom, and Assyria will have a great future again in the day of the Lord. So there's a lot of redemptive history that's in that part of the world. Now, the sons of Ishmael, we all know, went down into Saudi Arabia and become these Bedouin tribes that are tend to be warlike. Muhammad the Prophet, seeing all the warlike polytheism and all these, the disunity in the tribes of Arabia, united them together under Allah. He wanted to see unity of these previously tribes, mostly Ishmaelites. They're warlike, kind of, warlike Bedouins. Oh boy, there's the hard.
Speak into the microphone.
I gave you. I brought a few copies. I should bring a few more copies of Ray Stedman's very great sermon on the 10 propositions concerning the nature of war. There are no just wars. War is always a judgment on all parties concerned. God can initiate war if He wants to for His own purposes. I'll bring that in so that, because it's well worth reading. Ray wrote that at 1982, I think, when we were concerned about nuclear war more than now, but it's still a very relevant message. It's on my website, yeah, and it's on Ray's, on the Stedman website also. Every war that I've ever known, all the way from World War II when I was a boy, there had always been anti-war protests. The anti-war protests this time seem to be not very well informed. We seem to have, because of all the moral relativism in our culture right now, you have people that legitimately protest against war. They feel in their hearts that war is wrong. What it's lacking, it seems to me, is, well, if war is wrong, what are you going to do about it? What is your proposed solution? How are you going to fix this? What are we going to do to stop this? Is Saddam Hussein a good guy? Should we let him stay there? These other side, the things that we take for granted as Christians, because we know the moral absolutes involved. We know that there's more than one side to things. Now, this war over there, I think, is worth praying about from the standpoint that if ancient Babylon is a kind of a wellspring of evil, and the strongholds of evil around Saddam Hussein are certainly demonic and deadly, that and the Christian church is the one body that can take on the angelic spiritual warfare, that we ought to be praying fervently for the whole military situation at all levels, not just for comfort, but we should be busily pulling down those strongholds of darkness over there. I think that this whole war is a threat to the kingdom of darkness to a great extent. That's why you get all this protest from secular society around here, is because this is a war that's going to change history in a major way. And the war could go very, very wrong. This is not an easy instant win, because just because you got a big army doesn't guarantee success in warfare at all. It's whether God's fighting with you or not.